I will take no offence. Thank you. He then led her through her first meeting with Russell Graves, from her point of view. She insisted she had known nothing of Winifred's existence. Graves appeared to be single, and behaved as if he were. He had courted her, she said, mentioning certain places and events they had attended together. He asked her to marry him, and she accepted. In time, they'd moved to their present address in the outskirts of London. Sarah had been born, and then Arthur. In none of that time had Graves made any mention of an earlier marriage. She knew nothing of the inheritance involving a title and estate. She'd learned of it only when Winifred arrived and demanded to see her. That must have been a tremendous shock to you, Daniel observed. Small compared to the news that she was Russell's legitimate wife, and I was a bigamist, and my children had no standing at all, she replied, her voice a little shaky. But you believed it. She had her marriage lines with her. I could hardly refute it. You believed her that there had been no divorce. Russell told me he'd never married before. If there had been a divorce, he would have said so, surely. Yes, I believed her. She'd come to reclaim her place, now that there was a title and money. If she were divorced, then she would have no claim. There would be no point in her coming. What did she expect you to do? Don't know. I was so horrified I called her a liar and said I would fight her, and that was when she lunged at me, and I stepped back and she slipped. She slapped me and I slapped her back. I think she was so surprised she stepped away and turned her ankle and fell sideways. Her voice was shaking. She struck her head on the corner of the hearthstone and she didn't move. Not at all. I stood for a moment expecting her to rise, but she didn't. She didn't move, even to breathe. I bent over her and that's when I realized she wasn't breathing. You knew that? Daniel asked. Well, I do now. Then I thought she was merely insensible. I stood up and I called for Sarah, my daughter. I knew she was in her room. Why? I thought she could help me lift her up, maybe put her on the bed and revive her. I told her to bring smelling salts. They're very sharp. If you faint... And did she? Yes, she brought the salts, but as soon as she kneeled by the woman and touched her, she realized she was dead. I told her what had happened. Ebony looked desperate. She had at first refused to involve Sarah at all, but Daniel had told her she wouldn't be believed if she said she had managed to lift the body without any help. And to implicate her lady's maid was not only untrue, it was monstrously unfair. Sarah herself would not allow it. And did Sarah help you to change the clothes on the dead woman, to those you were wearing? And the boots also? Daniel prompted. Griswood might have objected that Daniel was leading the witness, but he had nothing to gain from it, and sat instead with a half-smile on his face, almost a sneer of disbelief. Yes, Ebony admitted. Reluctantly. When the clothes were changed, you placed her back where she had originally fallen. Yes. You dressed in other clothes, leaving hers in your wardrobe, and then you left the house. Yes. Ebony's voice was growing fainter as she relived the horror, allowing Sarah to identify the body as yours. Yes. Why? Why did you do that, Miss Cumberford? Why not simply report the death that she had attacked you and slipped and fallen? It would have come out who she was, and therefore that my children were illegitimate. Is that all? She stared at him with anger in her face and utter misery. No. I was afraid of being beaten again. I was tired of it. It hurts when your bones are broken. It hurts appallingly. I couldn't take it another time. She did not add that Sarah had persuaded her to, although Sarah had told Daniel that herself. Ebony refused to compromise Sarah any more than she had to. The last time you were beaten was just recently, was it not? She closed her eyes as if she couldn't bear to see the expressions of pity and revulsion on people's faces. Yes. Did he injure you? Griswood stood up slowly. My lord, this is all very heartbreaking, I'm sure, but it's completely unprovable. Even if Miss Cumberford could embarrass us all by showing bruises, there's no proof where she got them or how. She could have slipped and fallen downstairs. He shrugged exaggeratedly. The judge looked at Daniel. This was the moment he'd been angling for. He must word it exactly. This chance would not come twice. My lord, I understand this is hard to believe, and the whole of Miss Cumberford's story is in the balance, as my learned friend suggests. Griswood hadn't gone so far as to say anything on it, but Daniel had.
Well, Mr. Pitt? The judge asked.
I call Miss Ford Croft to the stand, my lord.
Miss Ford Croft?
Griswood's eyebrows shot up.
In what capacity?
Daniel turned to the judge as if it were he who had asked. She has sat the degree examinations at Cambridge in medicine and in chemistry, my lord. I think that expertise will become apparent.
Oh, really?
Griswood was filled with derision. The judge looked up at him with dislike, then turned back to Daniel again.
Is she related to Marcus Ford Croft by any chance?
Yes, my lord. She's his daughter.
Very well. But you will have to allow Mr. Griswood to cross-examine her when you're finished.
He made it almost a question, giving Daniel time to withdraw if he thought it too much for Miriam. Daniel actually thought Miriam would take him to pieces if he decided not to question her. Miriam was duly sworn in and prepared to face Daniel. She was dressed in a deep wine-colored suit, very plain, but so well tailored, it managed to look businesslike yet feminine at the same time. She wasn't as slender as Daniel had remembered, and rather more gracefully curved. Her bright hair was coiled very fashionably. She looked fragile compared with the sturdiness of Griswood. Daniel was suddenly afraid for her. Perhaps this was a mistake. He wasn't willing to sacrifice Miriam, no matter how angry she might be, in order to save Ebony. There had to be another way.
Mr. Pitt!
The judge brought him sharply back to the present. Miss Fordcroft, would you tell his lordship and the court what expertise you have to give evidence before this court? What have you studied, where, and for how long? Did his voice sound as shaky and defensive as he felt?
I studied medicine for some 6 years, and chemistry for 5. At Cambridge, my lord. I passed all my exams with honours.
So, you have degrees in both medicine and chemistry? Daniel prompted.
No, sir.
She kept the anger from her face, but she couldn't hide the grief.
As may be apparent, I'm a woman.
I see, said Daniel. Or actually I don't see, but I have checked with the university and I know it is true. Thank you, Miss Ford Croft. He turned toward the judge. With his lordship's permission, I will now question you regarding your knowledge in this particular case.
Proceed,
the judge nodded his head fractionally. Yes, my lord. There was no help for it now. No way except ahead. Miss Ford Croft, the police surgeon examined the body by the fireplace and accepted Miss Graves' identification of it as Ebony Graves. In the course of my attempts to defend Mr. Graves, on the charge of having murdered his wife, did you have cause to examine that body yourself, and if so, what conclusions did you reach? Griswood rose to his feet and the judge ordered him to sit down before he could raise his objection.
I will tell the jury to ignore it if it is irrelevant, Mr. Griswood, he said sharply. Let us hear it first.
What did you find, Miss Fordcroft? Daniel asked. He was nervous now and it was reflected in his voice. He could hear it himself.
That the burns had been made after death, using linseed oil and oiled silk to ignite, as a safety match or possibly a taper from the fire,
Miriam replied.
And a certain amount of cotton had been used to carry the heat and provide fuel. I also x-rayed the bones and discovered that they had 4 old, well-healed breaks in them. 3 in the hand and arms, 1 in the ankle.
How did you know they were long-healed? He asked.
When a bone is healing, the body puts new calcium on the breach, rather as we would put cement on a piece of broken china. It thickens with time, and I have x-rays here that perhaps I will be allowed to show the jury.
She turned to the judge.
If I may, my lord.
She held up a very large photographic print. He put out his hand. She deliberately left the witness stand and walked gracefully across the floor of the court and offered him the photograph. A negative, rather than a print. It was shadowy, black and white, allowing the light through it.
Thank you.
He took the evidence and examined it.
That is a hand, she offered. It's rather beautiful, is it not? You can see the structure and how many bones there are in it. A most perfect instrument. Strong, easily manipulated, delicate, agile, and fit for an infinity of purposes.
The judge smiled.
You're very enthusiastic in your art, Dr. Miss Fordcroft.
Not my art, my lord. God's, or whoever you believe created us. I merely explain.
She handed him another picture. He looked at it, then at her.
What's this? This is not a hand.
No, my lord. It is a clavicle, a collarbone, if you like. And this leading off here,
she pointed,
is a shoulder blade. And you can see the spine behind it.
These white marks,
he asked, frowning at her.
Here and here?
She looked at him.
They are places where the bones have been broken. And here. This one was some time ago. It's now healed. This one was more recent. That, I should judge, was less than a year ago.
He looked startled.
Good God! What happened to her?
I believe she was systematically beaten and abused, my lord.
What on earth kind of life did she lead? No wonder she sought to relieve it by making claims on Mr. Graves.
Miriam cleared her throat.
These are not pictures of Winifred Graves's bones, my lord. These are pictures of the right shoulder and arm of Miss Cumberford, Mrs. Graves, as she believed she was until Winifred turned up. That is when Ebony took the chance to escape, even at such cost to her reputation, her well-being, and the temporary loss of her children.
The judge stared at her, for a moment, wordless.
If I may offer an opinion, my lord,
Miriam continued before the judge could speak,
I do not think that these shoulders of Miss Cumberford would have had the physical strength to fight Winifred. There are many other injuries, to both fingers and toes, in addition to two broken ribs, a broken ulna, the lower arm, and a broken fibula in the left leg. All of them are healed, but over a space of approximately 20 years.
Good God! Exclaimed the judge. And do you swear to this, Miss Fordcroft?
Yes, my lord. But if you have any doubt, they can be x-rayed again. The results will be the same.
I recall breaking my heel once when I was a young man. The pain was extraordinary. This woman must have suffered beyond my imagination.
Yes, my lord. And been very afraid. I found two broken ribs in Miss Sarah also. I did not examine Mr. Arthur.
Show these images to the jury, said the judge. If they have any questions, answer as best you can.
Daniel remained standing, swinging between hope and despair, while the jury examined the x-rays with fascination. Each at one time or another looked across at Graves, then at the white-faced figure of Ebony. Griswood started to make some protest, but then thought better of it. Daniel wondered what it would be and how he would contain it. Would Graves say he wasn't responsible? It was preposterous that some other man was systematically beating his first wife, and then his second wife, and then his daughter, and he hadn't known of it. Miriam left the x-rays with the jury and returned to the witness stand. The judge offered Griswood the chance to cross-examine Miriam, but he had no questions for her. The jury looked aghast, but in admiration and delight at the complicated and beautiful pictures of bones. Daniel saw at least two of the jurors hold up their own hands and gaze at them, as if marveling at their beauty, as if they could imagine what existed beneath the ordinary flesh. The judge requested summations, and they were both brief. Griswood concentrated on the broken law and the fact that Ebony had acted a lie. But for Daniel, she would have allowed her husband to be hanged. Daniel rose to his feet. He still had all to win or lose. He looked at Graves, at the sweat on his face. He must beat him. Not only for Ebony, but for Sarah and Arthur, and for the family of servants. Most personally, he must discredit Graves for his own father's sake. Gentlemen of the jury, which of you has children? He saw most of them nod. Some smiled. When they were young, you would do anything to protect them. When they became older, did you love them any less? If a man threatened your daughter, would you not leap to defend her and perhaps think afterward? Daniel spoke softly, although his voice carried in the silence.
And her mother? Have you ever tried to tear a child from their mother? Have you not seen a woman labor all day to care for her child, sit up all night to nurse them when they are sick, defend them, rightly or even wrongly, when they are criticized? Have you not seen her go without food, giving her own portion to her child?
Of course you have. So have I. As children, we wouldn't survive if our parents didn't defend us when we were too small and too weak to defend ourselves. Even a grown man in terror or despair, in unbearable pain, will think of his mother. He had said enough and he knew it. Ebony Cumberford knew of the beatings. Indeed, she took most of them herself. But on the day Winifred turned up and made a lie of Ebony's marriage, the safety of her children, Sarah's chance at a decent marriage, and, more importantly, Arthur's continued need for medical treatment, eclipsed good manners, common sense, and any consequences to herself. She was a mother defending her children. In Arthur's case, a crippled child who could not possibly defend himself. He looked at the face of each juror in turn. Winifred died trying to attack Ebony, he continued. It was an accident. She fell back on the hearthstone. No one could have attacked her from behind at that angle. The stone couldn't have been raised up to strike her. Certainly, Ebony took advantage of the situation and disfigured her and redressed her so she would be taken for Ebony. And yes, although she didn't foresee it at the time, the death wouldn't be perceived as the accident it was, but as murder. And Russell Graves was charged with it and found guilty. He shook his head. Ebony didn't plan that. All she planned was to escape the beatings before he finally went too far and killed her or one of her children. If she was dead, then who would care for Sarah and Arthur? Falthorn would do what he could, but Russell Graves could get rid of him with a word, and he would. Yes, Ebony was wrong. But which of you would do less? She's guilty of having disfigured a dead body. She's not guilty of murder. She came forward before her tormentor was hanged. She let him suffer. Perhaps he was even as afraid for a few days as she was most of her life with him. But she didn't let him die. I ask you to find her not guilty of killing Winifred Graves, or of knowingly committing bigamy by marrying Russell Graves, but only of damaging a corpse and defending her children with all of her strength. The jury retired. Daniel paced the floor in the hallway outside the courtroom. He couldn't bring himself to leave, even for a cup of tea or a glass of ale. Kitteridge waited with him. Seemingly he cared just as much. "She's damn good, Miriam," was all Kitteridge said. "Yes," Daniel agreed, his throat too tight to say more. Time seemed to stretch endlessly, but it was actually only just over half an hour when they were called back into the courtroom. They wouldn't hang her, would they? They couldn't. Daniel could scarcely breathe. The foreman rose to his feet. He looked nervous. "Have you reached a verdict?" the judge inquired. "We have, my lord." "How find you?" "With respect, my lord, we find the accused not guilty." Daniel was almost numb with amazement, relief, joy. The first thing he was aware of was Kitteridge hugging him. He immediately hugged him back and found his eyes were full of tears. It was seconds before he even saw Marcus, and behind him, his own father and mother, smiling. Epilogue. The second Sunday after the trial ended, Mercy Blackwell gave an afternoon tea party. Daniel was one of the first to arrive. The only other people already present were Marcus Ford Croft, looking faintly uncomfortable, and Miriam, who was sitting beside an unnecessarily large fire for midsummer, and smiling. "Come in, Daniel, come in," Blackwell invited expansively. "We are celebrating." Daniel felt a stir of anxiety. What had Blackwell been up to? Really, what in particular? The instant he said it, he regretted asking. He would probably be much happier not to know. "Everything," Blackwell smiled. "Graves has been sentenced to 7 years for bigamy. I think the judge took a dislike to him. Very natural after Miss Ford Croft's exposure of his wretched character. We shall take great delight in missing him. For a long time. But fortunately, since he's not dead, we don't need to be anxious as to who inherits his property, particularly his house." "Houses," Mercy corrected him. "Tea, Daniel." "Thank you," he accepted. She poured him a cup and cut a large slice of Madeira cake for him. It was one of his favorites. She didn't need to ask. Daniel turned to Marcus Ford Croft. Will Ebony be able to live there? She's not his wife, nor does she wish to be. No, but Arthur is his son, Marcus Ford Croft replied, and he's more than willing to have his mother and sister live with him, and of course the full family staff. We're expecting them any minute. The purple chair should be comfortable for Arthur. How will he? Daniel began. Don't fuss. Blackwell waved away the question. Falthorn will carry him. It's good he should see the outside world for a change. And when Graves comes out? For heaven's sake, we've got at least 6 years to settle that. Maybe all seven. Anything could happen. We'll have to see that it does. There was a knock on the door, and Blackwell went to open it. He came back triumphantly, leading Falthorn, who was carrying Arthur in his arms, followed by Ebony Graves, and behind her, Sarah. Greetings were exchanged, and Arthur settled comfortably, and was provided with a small table, upon which rested hot tea, slices of cake, and a tray of jam tarts. Daniel went over to speak to Miriam, who seemed to be absorbed in watching the fire burn. Did she feel so alone here, away from her work, and its fascination and safety? He could think of a dozen things he wanted to say to her, yet none of them came to his lips. Is the Madeira cake good? She said, with a wry smile. Mercy made it especially for you. He looked at her plate and saw that she had none. I'm sorry, how inconsiderate of me. Take mine. He offered it to her. I'll get some more. No, thank you. I've already had a jam tart. They are my weakness. Would you like another? Now that they had nothing to talk about, he had lost his ease in speaking to her. It had seemed so effortless before. Later, perhaps, she answered. Sarah looks a lot better, doesn't she? He turned to look and found Sarah looking back at him, her face filled with gratitude. Arthur, too, turned toward him and smiled, then gazed back at the room and the multitude of pictures, ornaments, and mementos that filled it. Kitteridge was the last to arrive. He came in as angular as usual, seeming all legs and elbows and wearing a most flamboyant necktie. Mercy made him welcome and offered him tea and fruitcake, which he accepted warmly and narrowly missed spilling over Sarah. He apologized profusely, and she assured him that it was perfectly all right. It wasn't his fault at all. A slight flush spread up Kitteridge's cheeks. Daniel looked away, conscious of staring. It seemed the only thing left to worry about was Graves's manuscript, but that mattered more to him than he dared tell anyone else. They all looked so relieved, he felt selfish to darken the party with his own fears. Miriam reached forward and gave the fire another dig with the poker, and it seemed to gain new energy. "Are you cold?" he said incredulously. "Oh, no. Thank you." She hesitated a moment. "Are you still worried about the manuscript, Daniel?" "Yes," he admitted. She gave a sweet, gentle smile. "Don't be," she said, and gave the fire another sharp prod. "It will never see the light of day, I promise you." "How can you be so sure?" he pressed. "Daniel, would you reach into the coal scuttle?" He lifted the lid, and his fingers touched a thin pile of paper. He pulled out the last pages of the manuscript. With a flood of relief, he passed them to her, and silently she fed them to the fire. The End. This book was read for you by Samuel Rukin, a member of SAG-AFTRA. We hope you have enjoyed this production of 21 Days, a Daniel Pitt novel by Anne Perry. Recorded books are available wherever audiobooks are sold, including Audible.com, Audiobooks.com, Apple iTunes, and in public libraries through RB Digital. Thank you for being a Recorded Books reader.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.